And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Town.
Hey, welcome to part two of our conversation with Don Black about his best-selling memoir, The Sanest Guy in the Room. As we mentioned in part one, I came up with the title of the book more or less as a throwaway line somewhere or other many years ago, contrasting Don with some of his more mercurial collaborators. And it's true. If the other guys in the room are Andrew Lloyd Webber, Barbara Streisand, Michael Jackson, Don is almost weirdly normal. As he discussed last time, his breakthrough pop hit, the song that started it all for him, was Walk Away for Matt Monro. And then some years later, he decided he loved writing for the theatre. But Don's like the old school guys in the 30s and 40s, the Rodgers and Harts and Irving Berlins, in that even when he's writing for the West End or Broadway, it's nice to get a pop hit out of it. From Sunset Boulevard, this was a top five smash. Dina Carroll at New Year in the 90s.
Ring out the old, bring in the new. A midnight wish to share with you. Your lips are warm, my head is light. Were we in love before tonight? With me, next year will be the perfect year.
And even when the show's a bit wobbly and unfocused, maybe there's a big song in it. From a musical he wrote about agony aunts, Advice Columnists, this was a big hit for Hot Chocolate in 1978 around Europe and the Commonwealth.
When you can't take anymore, when you feel your life is over, put down your tablets and pick up your pen, and I'll put you together again.
Lyrics by Don Black, music by, no, not Mozart, but Jeff Stevens. As we discussed at the end of part one, writing musicals is more fraught than writing pop songs, and suddenly hitherto sane people are throwing chairs around. That's not Don's style, as we'll hear in just a moment, but here's a kind of chair-throwing song, an angry song. He and Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote for Marty Webb in Tell Me on a Sunday, that gave Marty a top three hit in 1980.
Have you ever, because you've worked with Julie Stein, the great composer of Gypsy and Funny Girl, you did Bar Mitzvah Boy with him. There comes a point, he was a guy who liked to yell. It didn't take a lot to make him start yelling. Have you actually ever gone in for the chair breaking route? Have you ever tossed the papers up in the air and walked out?
No, I haven't. If I ever got uptight, I just leave. But I wouldn't make a scene. I just go home and have a cup of tea. And because I don't think it does any good. You know, people say a lot of things when in temper. But there are, you know, I've had, you know, obviously you've had, not arguments, but serious debates about what's right and what's wrong. And you learn that over the years. You do, you know, when I wrote Maybe That's Your Problem, you know, you just go along with anything because what do I know about it? It's my first musical. And it takes three or four musicals before you stand up for yourself. And you say, no, that it doesn't work for me, and that's it, you know. But you don't have to, your veins don't have to start coming out of your cheek.
I remember one time at the Vivian Ellis Awards, which was, as you write about in the book, it was a, it ran for years, was a competition to find great new musical talent. It was a competition for composers and lyricists, and a lot of them, as you say, were absolutely terrible. And you and Tim Rice and Vivian Ellis, you were often quite cruel to the contestants. And I remember after it one year where you'd like totally dismissed this one work, and the author was there sort of moaning, complaining, bitterly eviscerating the judges for completely misunderstanding her masterpiece. And you said, "Have a nice cup of tea and sit down for half an hour. You'll soon feel okay." And that was your way of calming her down. But that actually is quite good advice in these situations.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to be cruel. It isn't nice to be cruel to people who are starting off. But I remember Cameron McIntosh saying to someone, "This is just awful. And if I were you, I wouldn't give up your day job. And if you have given it up already, try and get it back."
That's just actually making the old cliche even worse, isn't it? That's just twisting the knife on the old cliche. That's merciless. Merciless. That I ought to ask you, Don, because it's one of those things that you write beautiful, tender lyrics, and we were talking about "Tell Me on a Sunday," and that's just like a lyrical tour de force. And then that was originally sung by Marty Webb, and Marty Webb was one of those people you managed, Marty. And you managed Matt Monro, and you've managed a few other people over the years, and that's basically your hobby. I think years ago I asked you, well, why do you could write these beautiful lyrics? Why do you want to be booking Matt Monro into some club in Newcastle or whatever, and checking that the piano's in tune? And you said it was because you didn't play golf, that kind of thing was like your hobby.
Well, nowadays, someone interviewed me the other day about the book, and they said to me, "Why are you always so busy? Why do you keep working so hard?" And I said, "It stops me monitoring my decline." And I thought it was a good answer. And it's true. If you're doing nothing, and you're getting on a bit, you keep thinking, "Oh, that hurts, this thing. I wonder if I'm all right. I better check my cholesterol." If you've got nothing to do, but it's so important. You know, if Charles Aznavour once said to me, "A man will never grow old if he knows what he's doing tomorrow."
Right, right.
And I think that's a lovely phrase, and I think it's true. And I know tomorrow I'll be writing a show for the BBC, so I know what I'm doing the next few days.
Yeah, it's a little bit different though when you're young and you're doing that, because Elton John and Bernie Taupin came to see you and wanted you to manage them. So you must have, you know, I know there's people you have a relationship with, like Matt Monro, you'd known for, it was a natural thing and it arose from your friendship, but you must have been quite good at it if Elton and Bernie show up at your door and want you to do the same for them.
Well, yes. I mean, at the time I said no to them.
And that was, as you say in the book, imagine what they could have been if only you'd said yes.
The last person I managed was Michael Ball. And that's It came about because of Aspects of Love, and I wrote Love Changes Everything.
Love changes everything, hands and faces, earth and sky. Love changes everything, how you live and how you die. Love can make the summer fly, or a night seem like a lifetime. Yes, love changes everything. Now I tremble at your name. Nothing in the world will ever be the same.
And at the time, Andrew said to me, we got to make sure he does the right things. He had an agent who was a very old agent who didn't know anything about this kind of thing. And he said, you know how to. So I looked after Michael, made sure he was on the right TV shows and the radio shows and the right interviews. And I managed him for about a year or so. But then it gets too heavy. You've got to go to Blackpool because he's doing something. But, you know, I do enjoy that because I'm good with creative people. I just tune into them very quickly.
A show of yours I loved that wasn't a hit called Budgie, and I can still remember the big number, They're Naked and They Move, about striptease in Soho, and that starred Adam Faith, who was a big pop star in the late 50s, early 60s. But by the time you were working on Budgie with him, he just, you know, it was Adam Faith in Budgie, but Adam Faith didn't want to do any TV or radio or promote the show.
No, he was very difficult. He had another career as a financial dabbler, and he had a column in some paper. And he had a table at Fortnum & Mason's, the store. And he would be there most of the day talking to hedge fund people and financial advisors, and he was hardly ever there. And then when I asked him, you know, that you've got to promote this show, Adam, you've got to do something. And he said to me, I asked myself every time, would Marlon Brando do it? he said, that's how I live my career, would Marlon Brando? I phoned him up one day and said, I don't know how to tell you this, but Marlon Brando is on the Gloria Hunniford show next week. It's very funny. But he didn't do anything to promote it. But I love that show. And again, it was a pleasure to work with Mort Shuman, the wonderful Mort Shuman, who wrote so many hits for Elvis Presley.
Yeah, and Save the Last Dance for Me and did all those Jacques Brel things, and a lovely man. You guys, songwriting is a community. And many years ago, you got together with the guys who basically wrote all the big British pop hits of the 60s and 70s, Delilah and Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes and The Last Waltz and all this thing. And you formed a society, the Society of Distinguished Songwriters, called SODS, which is in some strange way, it's like a kind of parody ASCAP, as it were. It's like just a bunch of songwriters who all get together and you sing your own songs, and you have these big nights out. And it's a real community, that, isn't it? And you're usually the compere because you're the one who gets our friend Herbie Kretzmer, who wrote Les Miserables and died a few weeks ago. You were the one who gets to introduce Herbie on stage.
Well, we have something very special for you now. Susan Boyle's record of I Dreamed a Dream is the number one record around the world today. And the song comes from Les Miserables, and it was written by one of our most distinguished sons, a giant of a man in many ways, the extraordinary Herbert Kretzmer.
This was written 25 years ago, and the song's still going, thank God. And as anybody who knows me knows, I can't sing, so I'm going to speak it in my usual inimitable way, I hope. It's called I Dreamed a Dream, which a lady called Susan Boyle sang. All I can say is thank you, Susie.
Introduce Les Reed and Barry Mason and Tony McCauley, and you all just have a good time. But what's interesting is you've kept going, and Les Reed and Barry Mason and Tony McCauley, at a certain point, they all just retire to the golf course and accept that it's over, and you've kept going.
That's because they don't feel as passionate about it as I do. You know, I've often said to Jeff Stevens, who wrote There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World and Winchester Cathedral, when was the last time you picked up a copy of Music Week, which is our paper, or Variety or anything? They're completely out of it. They're not really interested in the business. They're interested in they're writing their songs, but they're just not. I mean, Herbie was the greatest. You know, most songwriters are. I said at his funeral the other week, I spoke at his funeral. And I said about Herbie, I gave this little anecdote, which is true. You know, we used to meet at the RAC Club at the Turkish Bath every Saturday. And he said to me, Don, I've got this musical, Our Man Crichton. He said, it wasn't a hit, but I'm sure there's life in it. So I said, well, it ran for a few months in London. I said, why don't you drop Cameron McIntosh your life? He said, I don't know the man. I said, you don't have to know the man. So the following week, I said, have you written to Cameron? He said, no, I don't know. I mean, how do you start? I said, don't be so stupid. He's very approachable, Cameron. Another couple of weeks goes, but have you done it? No. Where is he? Next week, this went on and on. And I said, gave him his address. We wrote the letter together in the Turkish bath to Cameron McIntosh. It's an amazing story, really. And one day, weeks went by. He came to my flat and he said, Don, I went to see Cameron McIntosh. I said, that's fantastic, Herbie. What happened? He said, he's not at all interested in Our Man Crichton. But he asked me if I'd be interested in this. And he showed me a copy of Les Miserables. And he said, as you've worked with Charles Aznavour, maybe you'd like to do this. So at this funeral, I said, I had nothing to do with Les Miserables, but I had everything to do with getting Herbie Kretzmer off his ass.
Because if you hadn't actually sat down and co-written the letter to Cameron McIntosh, whom he didn't know, he wouldn't have ever been in the room to be offered Les Miserables.
That's correct. But he did a great job. But my God, most songwriters I know are hustlers. You know, that's what we are. You have to be. Herbie was never like that.
No. Well, you always, I think in that situation, if you have Herbie's disposition, you know, you always think that you'll write a song and sooner or later its worth will be discovered and made known to the world. And it doesn't, it's never like that. It's like the difference between Herbie and some guy who's writing a song in Pocatello or wherever, is that it's at a certain point you have to be able to push it out there and bring it to somebody who matters and who's going to do something with it.
Yes, well, Herbie's work with Aznavour was very, very successful. Yesterday When I Was Young and She had become standards. But Herbie never wallowed in it. You know, if I said to Herbie, I love your lyric on Yesterday When I Was Young, he'd just nod.
Yeah.
He didn't want to keep that conversation going.
No, but he would do that with other people. I heard a tape the other day of Herbie back in the 70s introducing Arthur Schwartz at a private concert at the American Embassy in London. And Herbie loved Arthur Schwartz's songs and said all the sort of things to Arthur that you said to him that he didn't want to hear about Yesterday When I Was Young. Everybody's a bit like that, don't you think?
No, there are people who wallow in self, adulation.
Okay, let me ask you about one of the revelations in the book, because I was actually shocked by this. As you know, you've told me about it. Steven Spielberg's favorite opening credit sequence on a film, any film, is Diamonds Are Forever, because he loves the way the visuals are, not obviously, not over literally, but they're attuned to the lyrics of the song you wrote. And he had one big moment with you in Trump Tower, where you and he are going on about, he's going on about what a fabulous sequence this is, the way the light changes on the word lust and everything.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need. Please me, they can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever. Hold one up and then caress it. Touch it. Stroke it and undress it. I can see every part. Nothing hides in the heart to hurt me. I don't need love. For what good will love do me? Diamonds never lie. Round my little finger. Unlike men, the diamonds linger. Men are mere mortals who are not worth going to your grave for.
For what I didn't realize, because you published some of your lyrics in this book, is that there's a whole 8 bars or whatever it is, an extra chunk of Diamonds Are Forever that never made it into that famous sequence because you'd run out of time. They only needed a song of a certain length, and once they'd had that, they didn't want your extra 8 bars getting in the way. And I'd never known that before, and it's a fantastic extra segment. And I think of all the records that have been made where people, they sing the chorus, there's an instrumental break, and then they come back for the final 16 bars or whatever it is and sing what they'd sung before.
I don't need love, for what good will love do me? Diamonds never lie to me. For when love's gone, they luster on. Diamonds are forever, forever, forever. Diamonds.
for almost 50 years now, they could have been singing this extra unknown lyric. Why did you just like sit on it?
Well, what could you do with it? You'll notice, because you're a song surgeon, that the new verse, or the discarded verse, it rhymes, go to your grave for. And the other one was crave for. It always worried me because, you know, brave for is on its own. It really glues together when you hear the other verse, which ends up with crave for, you know, the flesh you, diamonds you crave for, whatever it is. But that's just being picky about it. No, it was just 30 seconds too long for the film, so they had to cut one verse. But you know, who's going to sing Diamonds Are Forever these days? Times have changed.
Wait a minute, because just a few years ago, you had, I don't quite understand her background, but she's a young singer. She's a huge success in the UK, and she's basically Northern Irish via the Ukraine or somewhere. I don't even know how that happens. I didn't even know there were people in the Ukraine desperate to flee to Belfast. It's weird to me. But she's a huge star in the UK, and you've actually written songs with her, and on a tribute night to you, she actually sang, you say, Who Wants to Sing Diamonds Are Forever? Well, she did, and in a dramatically different way.
And it was beautiful. It was very impressive. Just, we're talking about Katie Melua.
Right.
And she just sang it, you know, with a guitar, very simply. And it was gorgeous.
It was. And I ought to correct myself too, Don, because I got my Soviet republics mixed up. Katie wound up in Ulster via Soviet Georgia.
Diamonds are forever. They are all I need to please me. They can stimulate and tease me. They won't leave in the night. I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever. Touch it, stroke it, and undress it. I can see every part, nothing hides in the heart to hurt me. Forever, forever, diamonds are
Katie Mellower has made a lovely record of it. It will be sampled or something else, but I can't imagine someone else. But yeah, it's lovely. It's very nice when someone cuts it. I tell you another, just going back to something you said earlier, when you talked about the Smiths, I also had another one, a lovely sample of a song. I did. It wasn't a well-known song, but it was a big hit in America, and it was Eminem. I wrote a song called Reaching Out, and it, Queen recorded.
Lately I've been hard to reach. I've been too long on my own. Everybody has a private world where they can be alone. Are you calling me? Are you trying to get through? Are you reaching out for me? Like I'm reaching out for you.
And that was sampled in America, Eminem sampled it, and it's called it Beautiful. And so it's one of their biggest hits, Eminem.
Lately I've been hard to reach. I've been too long on my own. Everybody has a private world where they can be alone. Are you calling me? Are you trying to get through? Are you reaching out? I'm reaching out for you.
I'm just so f***ing depressed, I just can't seem to get out this slump. If I could just get over this hump, but I need something to pull me out this dump. I took my bruises, took my lumps, fell down and I got right back up. But I need that spark to get psyched back up in order for me to pick the mic back up. I don't know how or why or when.
So I'm very cool, I'm very trendy, Mark.
Yeah, I'm slightly freaked out by that, because everybody from Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra to Eminem and the Smiths have recorded your songs. Where do you come down on that spectrum? Who, when you write a song, you know, Julie Stein, as you know, he'd be working on a show with you or someone else, and he'd go, "This would be great for Barbara. This would be great for Frank." He was thinking like that. When you write a song, you worked with Matt Monro for so many years. Is it Matt's voice that is singing the song back to you in your ears when you put it down on paper?
It's a very good question. It's a mixture of Matt Monro and Anthony Newley. I've always loved Tony Newley. I knew him well. And he was a great storyteller and one of the great cabaret artists. And and when I sing it to myself, I am a bit of Newley-esque.
Right, that's it. Well, he could sell anything. I mean, he could make you go out and buy Pop Goes the Weasel, which yes, I don't think Eminem could.
Yeah. Half a pound of tuppenny rice, half a pound of treacle. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel.
What I love about the book is there's just the stories you have to tell are great. You knew all those old Friars Club guys in New York when you got to New York. So like Henny Youngman, who said of Don Black, "This man needs no introduction. What he needs is an act," which is like the perfect Henny Youngman line. There's the other constant presence throughout the book is your wife Shirley, and you didn't have, even though you were doing all these stand-up gags, and you've always had a sort of stand-up persona. So I remember you once comparing old musicals to an ex-wife who won't ever go away, and it was a funny line. But of course, you never had an ex-wife. You found the perfect someone, and you stayed with that perfect someone for over 60 years. You met when you were very young. I think Shirley was a year older than you, so you were like her toy boy. And but you stayed together all through those years. And there's a very poignant moment when you're talking about getting together with your sons, and you're all kind of aware that you're not mentioning Shirley because you know it would make you all sad. If you were to bring her up and start talking about her and all the rest. And she was a part, I can't count the number of times that first nights in London and in New York where she'd be there with you in a way that a lot of the spouses of people who have to go to first nights, knowing what they're in for, will find an excuse to check out and not come along. And she was like, she was the perfect other half of you. And are there moments she had her, I think Shirley's favorite song was It Had to Be You. Is popular song and the sentiments of popular song a consolation for grief and a loss that deep? Do you find it comforts you to think, oh yeah, Shirley liked that song?
Not yet. It's been 2.5 years. And yeah, we were together for so long. And unlike, you know, most marriages have ups and downs, we never had any downs at all. Mm. We had 60 years of unrivaled happiness. Mm. And since I've been alone, I don't think I've met anyone who's been married for that long. Mm. Everyone I've met has had a troubled marriage, or it's their second wife or the third, yeah, this or that. I realize how lucky, it's unheard of. David Walliams, the guy here who's very well-known comedian, yeah, actor, he said, this will never happen again, Don. Anyone who gets married today will not be married for 60 years. It just can't happen in today's world.
No.
But the thing is, and I appreciate, and the boys, Grant and Clive, they know what she gave to us. I mean, we were the happiest people in the world. And we don't mention her at times because we know it's not a sadness thing. It's we know that evening goes that way. I mean, they say there's various stages of grief. I forget what they are. There's five stages, but the last one is acceptance. Mm. And I still find it very hard to accept. You start off with denial, and eventually it goes to acceptance. The thing is, you know, as I was afraid in the book that it might get a bit mawkish, because I see notes around here in my house, and it says, must call the plumber, right, must buy tomatoes. And, you know, and I cannot get rid of those little notes. Now, if you've never lost anyone, then I think you would say, what's he on about? It sounds so stupid. But if you have lost someone and you've been together, you know, and it's been the love of your life, it will sound accurate.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's Shirley never presented herself that way, but she was actually extremely sharp and perceptive about everything you did. And I remember sitting in Sardi's with you and Shirley in New York a few years ago, and we were talking generally about the music business. And Shirley said, even when you have a hit, it isn't really a hit, by which she meant, you know, you don't make as much money out of it as you would have when Moonlight Serenade was at the top of the charts, or There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World Tonight. And I always, when people talk to me about that, I always use Shirley's line as actually the great summation of what's happened to the music business in recent decades, because she actually, even when you have a hit, it isn't a hit. It isn't really a hit, you know.
No. Well, yesterday I did a television show, a live TV show for Sky Arts, and I talked about Cole Porter. Hmm. And of course, I don't think anyone who writes songs today would live like him, with butlers and horses and stuff like that. It was a whole different world, that world. Years ago, I mean, I've said this in my book, when I wrote Born Free, there were 600 covers on that song. Everyone recorded.
Right.
But nowadays, Skyfall, I don't think anyone recorded it apart from Adele. So it's very hard to keep a standard, to make a standard out of anything.
I always remember with Born Free, like within a couple of weeks of you winning the Oscar, you had so many cover versions that you had artists with the same surname. So you had a big record by Roger Williams and you had a big record by Andy Williams. And I guess it's harder with Adele and Eminem these days, but it's like, that's how big the song was. You were getting cover versions by different singers with the same name. It was bizarre like that. I heard you on the radio the other day, and you were playing what you called old songs. You played three or four really old songs. So you played Roses of Picardy, which is a beautiful song from the Great War. So it's whatever it is now, 105 years old. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song. And I remember Barbara Cook having a conversation just sort of backstage with Barbara Cook, the great cabaret singer. And we were talking about whether the songs she sang and the people you admire, the songs they wrote. And she was saying, well, I remember when I was a kid and my grandparents and my parents used to get excited about hearing songs from the turn of the century. So, you know, Casey would waltz with the Strawberry Blonde and the band played on. Meet Me Tonight in Dreamland, Little Grey Home in the West, When You Come to the End of a Perfect Day. And she said, and those songs, nobody, you know, my grandparents loved those songs and knew every word, and nobody sings them now. And she goes, and I worry that we're not aware of it, but the same thing is going to happen to Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hart and Jerome Kern.
I think it's on the card. A song you left out, which is one I love, is If You Were the Only Boy in the World.
Oh, yeah, lovely, lovely. Yeah, Clifford Gray, a great British lyricist. Yeah, yeah.
If you were the only girl in the world, and I were the only boy, nothing else would matter. Garden of Eden, just made for two, with nothing to mar our joy. I would say such wonderful things to you. There would be such wonderful things to do if you were the only girl in the world and I were the only boy.
There would be a garden of Eden.
Well, I say in my book, I am very nervous of the great American songbook going away for good. because I've had a show on BBC for 7 or 8 years, and I played Gershwin and Frank Lesser and all these great people. I haven't been replaced by anyone who does the same. And you know, they're going for a younger audience. I have been asked to do other things for the BBC, so I may be coming back in a different way. But Michael Feinstein has a foundation for keeping the songbook alive. But I can imagine in 10 years' time that no one's going to hear Moon River again. Oh, well, I'm earlier than that. I mean, there's one of Body and Soul.
Right.
And, Someone to Watch Over Me and things like that, which I just think are just beautiful songs. And it hurts. I mean, I play these songs. I have done all my life to my sons. So they know as much about those songs as I do. And I'm pleased because they will teach their kids that. But it's a sad day indeed when these great songs are no longer heard.
Let me ask you just finally, Don, to return to Shirley. You talk throughout the book about songs you like and that you didn't write, but that you happen to like, and songs that other, I mean, Van Morrison loves Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and so does Tim. That for some reason, that song in particular seems to speak to some of the rockier guys. But there's a very poignant moment when you talk about a Paul Williams song and a line in there. It's "You and Me Against the World." And Paul Williams wrote a lot of hits for the Carpenters, and he had some kind of personal problems, and he sort of went away and he never quite came back, but he left, you know, a lot of really a small select group of great songs. And "You and Me Against the World" is the one that speaks to you, and the one that there's the line in there that I guess you'd heard that song for years, and it was only after you lost Shirley that the line resonated.
Well, having known grief, I think it's the best line about grief. Well, one of the songs, apart from that one, which I've always, it really turns me upside down when I hear it, is "I'll Only Miss Her When I Think of Her," which is a beautiful song. If you've lost someone, it speaks to you. But the line that I think is the best is in that song by Paul Williams. The last couple of lines are, "When one of us is gone and one of us is left alone to carry on. This is the line, then remembering will have to do."
Right.
Then remembering will have to do. Because no matter how many times people say to me, "You had 60 glorious years together. What a life you've had." And I think of that line, but now remembering will have to do.
Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world. When all the others turn their back and walk away, you can count on me to stay. Remember when the circus came to town, and you were frightened by the clown? Wasn't it nice to be around someone that you knew? Someone who was big and strong and looking out for you and me against the world. Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world. For all the times we've cried, I always felt the odds were on our side. And when one of us is gone and one is left alone to carry on, well then remembering will have to do. Our memories alone will get get us through. Think about the days of me and you, of you and me against the world. Well, life can be a circus, the underpaid overworkers. No, we seldom get our due, but when each day's through, bring my tired body home and look around for you and me against the world. It feels like you and me against the world. For all the times we cried, I've always felt that God was on our side. Baby, when one of us is gone, one is left alone to carry on. Then remembering we'll have to do, memories alone will get us through. We'll think about the days of me and you, you and me against the world.
That is a beautiful song. And, you know, Paul Williams was like 28 or something when he wrote that. And yet he said it for people four times his age, basically. Yes. It's a terrific line, that. I'd like to end with one of yours, because it goes back to where you began, where you started, with Udo Jürgens, who's this Austrian composer. And in those days, people had big hits on the continent. And at some point, someone would say, you know, we should really get an English lyric for that. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But in the 60s, there were a lot of big continental hits musically that were then given lyrics for the British and American markets. And in this case, Udo Jürgens had a tune that to me always sounds as, it's a great summation of a performer's life. And in a sense, at one remove, it's also a great summation of the guy who enables the performer, the songwriter who puts the words in his mouth. And that's If I Never Sing Another Song. It's a terrific number of yours, Don. How did that come your way?
He just sent me the tune. And that the words, If I Never Sing Another Song, just sat beautifully on those notes. And it's a very touching song. Everyone's recorded it of a certain type, of Shirley Bassey, of Frankie Lane, of Johnny Ray, I don't know. And, you know, I've just written another song for Shirley Bassey, which is a similar kind of song. Yeah. It's a marvelous sentiment, because people who've been in the business for so long, it's a little bit of Sunset Boulevard about it, a bit of Norma right. Desmond about it. Someone who's had better days. And it's a perfect song for someone who's looking back on their life. You know, I will get by, but I'm not sure how it finishes. Oh. I remember someone asked me, I had to write a sleeve note for Matt Monro on the compilation album. And I finished up by saying, if I never write another song, I can live with that, because I've had them sung by Matt.
In my heyday, young girls wrote to me. Everybody seemed to have time to devote to me. Everyone I saw all swore they knew me. Once upon a song, main attraction, couldn't buy a seat. The celebrities would die to meet. I've had every accolade bestowed on me, and so you see, if I never sing another song, it shouldn't bother me. I've had my share of fame, you know my name. If I never sing another song or take another bow, I would get by, but I'm not sure how. Always posing, but you love it all, though you have to learn to act like you're above it all. Everything I did, the world applauded. Once upon a star, framed citations hung on every wall. Got a scrapbook full of quotes I can't recall at all. There were times I felt the world belonged to me, and so you see, if I never sing another song, it shouldn't bother me. I've had my share of fame, you know my name. If I never sing another song or take another bow, I would get by, but I'm not sure how. La 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 la.
Well, that's a great sentiment. I know you've had them sung by Bing and Frank, yeah, and Morrissey and Eminem, but there's something special for you when they're sung, as you always put it, on the radio by the matchless Matt Monro. Don, I'm thrilled to have given you the title for your book. I have to say, it would have thrilled me even more if I'd come up to you and I'd said, hey, why don't you write a number called If I Never Write Another Song? I would rather have given you, and I think everybody feels like that, because songs seep under your skin in a way that no other art form does. But I'm happy to have made a small contribution to a terrific book, Don. And I know, as you say, you work, and it's on to the next thing. And you've got musicals about the Third Man and the Count of Monte Cristo, and you've probably got the Third Man meets the Count of Monte Cristo somewhere along the way, which is actually a great idea for a musical. and I know they stagger around, and sometimes they open and sometimes they don't open, but just actually surviving and prospering across the decades is impressive in itself. It's a fabulous book, and I hope everyone will go out and get it. Don Black, thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. God bless.
Mark Stein on the Town is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.